I wonder if you picked up in the news this month that the UK now has a Minister for Loneliness. So one of the government ministers is tasked with the issue of addressing the issue of loneliness. And at the end of last year, the Jo Cox Commission on Loneliness, you remember the MP who was very tragically murdered, Jo Cox, in the wake of her death, they set up a commission to address the issue of loneliness, and it reported that more than 9 million people in the country, I mean, obviously this must be an estimate, more than 9 million people in the country often or always feel lonely. And the Prime Minister has responded to that report by tasking one of her ministers with the job of implementing the recommendations from the Commission. And the Commission's chair, one of the MPs, Rachel Reeves, she sort of summed up the report like this. She said, the weakening of trade union, the weakening of church, the weakening of local pub and workplace ties have left us with a disconnected society. In the last few decades, loneliness has escalated from personal misfortune into a social epidemic. More and more of us live alone. We work at home more. We spend a greater part of our day alone than we did 10 years ago. It sometimes feels like our best friend is the smartphone. So that sort of situation feels pressing enough in society for the government to be concerned and worried about loneliness. But it's a complicated issue, isn't it? So loneliness is not the same as being alone. You can be alone, of course, and not at all feel lonely. But on the other hand, you may very well not live your life alone. You may live a life surrounded by people and yet still find yourself lonely. So Lydia Brownback is a Christian author who's written a particularly thoughtful book on this topic of loneliness. Lawrence pointed me to this book this week. And she describes her own sort of penny drop moment on this. Let me just read to her you a few paragraphs from her book. She's describing an occasion when she was talking to her neighbor. She says, the unexpected snowfall had brought the neighborhood together as we worked to clear cars and walkways before the early December sunset. Looks like winter's here, I called over to my friend next door. Indeed it is, she replied, and the timing of all this snow is perfect because after supper, we're going to make hot chocolate and decorate the Christmas tree. The kids are really excited. As I stood there picturing her happy family scene, I was suddenly buried under an avalanche of overwhelming loneliness. For the first time ever, I decided against getting a Christmas tree that year. The thought of having no one with whom to unwrap each memory-laden ornament from its tissue paper hibernation was just too depressing for me. And a casual conversation with my neighbor was all that it took. And then she says, a few Christmases later, determined to have for myself the sort of holiday fun my neighbor enjoyed with her family, I invited a few girlfriends to my home for a tree trimming party. And one friend, she says, was especially enthusiastic. And I asked her, why is coming to my place so great when you've got your own tree to decorate and a husband and kids to do it with you? Well, she said, let me tell you how that goes. We pick a day when we're going to do it. And I get treats prepared and Christmas music playing and all the ornaments are set out on the table. And when I'm ready, everyone wanders in. But 5 minutes into it, the phone calls and the texts and whatever else distract them. So they grab a cookie and disappear. And I wind up decorating the tree alone every year. She writes, how eye-opening that was for me. Those pictures of other people's lives that we get in our minds or we see on social media are rarely the reality. Behind the smiles and accolades and images of family fun lie all the normal stuff of everyone's life. There is heartbreak and rejection and anxiety and loneliness. It's quite poignant, isn't it, in the way in which she describes that. In other words, loneliness is something anyone can experience in all kinds of situations in life, from the elderly person who's isolated by frailty in life, or maybe someone caring for a poorly relative, to the student who's hidden in her room on her own, far from home and friends for the first time. Or you can be sitting in the middle of a classroom full of people and yet feel ever so lonely in the midst of it. In other words, meaningful friendships are a really crucial part of life. And so what we're going to do this evening is to look at the story of a friendship, one of the most famous friendships of history that's described in the Bible, this friendship between David and Jonathan that Lucy read for us a moment ago. And because it's quite a long section of 1 Samuel that describes this friendship, I just picked out some extracts to give us a feel for it. So that reading jumped around a little bit. But what we're going to see is the significance of friendship and the challenge of friendship and then the ultimate friendship. Okay? So just looking at that story of David and Jonathan's friendship, these are the things that stand out. First of all, the significance of friendship. Do you know the story? Just reading through that list of extracts there, there are three main characters that stand out from it, aren't there? There's David and Jonathan, their friendship, and then also Saul, King Saul. And Saul is, if you know the story, is the first ever king of Israel. They never had a king up till this point in their history. And he is the king, though, who was a disappointment, a false start, if you like. And he'd been rejected by God because he had refused to obey God. So what God had done is he had appointed the boy David as the king in waiting, as Saul's successor. Although at this stage in the story, that's not common knowledge, public knowledge. And David is relatively young, but he's popular and successful. And you remember the story early on in at this stage, just before these sections that we read, when David fought. I was telling this morning that whenever we get our picture book Bible out at home, my youngest child, she's 3, she always wants to turn from all the nice stories about creation and that lovely story about Ruth finding a husband and the story, you know, there's lots of lovely stories, aren't there? The one she wants is the one of David cutting off Goliath's head, okay, and beating him up. She's a sweet little girl, Lottie is. And anyway, that's happened. Goliath is defeated, killed by David. It's opened up military possibilities for Israel. David follows that with a series of military victories. He's very popular among the people, and King Saul is jealous. And the chapters represented by these extracts contain the details of 6 occasions, 6 different occasions, on which Saul tried to murder David. And it's in that context that we learn about this remarkable friendship between David and Jonathan. And one of the reasons is it's remarkable is that Jonathan was King Saul's son. See the significance of that in just a moment. But so what you've got in this story is you've got Saul, King Saul, trying to kill David, and King Saul's son trying to encourage and help David and strengthen him and keep him alive. King Saul's son, Jonathan, so is working against his father in that sense. And the writer of 1 Samuel flags up the significance of this David-Jonathan friendship for us. And he does it, well, as you see in verse 3 just there at the top of the readings, top of the extracts. Verse 3 says, Jonathan made a covenant with David. That is a deep committed friendship with him. And that's repeated again at the end of this description, long section about their friendship. Do you see down one of the end passages, chapter 23, verse 17, verse 18 down at the bottom of the extracts, the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. So at each end of this friendship in which Saul is trying to kill David, you've got it flagged up like bookends that Jonathan and David made a covenant, a committed friendship with each other, beginning and end. And one writer says the friendship bracketed and contained the evil that David had to cope with. Someone has put it like this: you can't get through adversity without friends, and you'll never get through life without adversity. And therefore, you'll never get through life without friendship. Do you see? Proverbs 17, verse 17, that's a good one to remember, 17:17, says, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. A friend loves at all times. A brother is born for adversity, because you can't get through adversity without friendship. And you'll never get through life without adversity. That's just fact of life. Therefore, you'll never get through life without friendship. You're going to need friendship to get through life, because life is difficult. And this friendship with Jonathan is what got David through. I mean, when we say, yeah, well, what about friendship? Yeah, I get that friendship's important. What about spouse relationships, husband, wives? What about brothers and sisters? And that's true, that those relationships are crucial in life, but only if they're friendship relationships too. It's not necessarily the case that a brother or a sister is a friend. It should be the case that a husband and wife are friends, but not necessarily, sadly. After Jonathan died, David hinted at that, didn't he? That this friendship, look what he says in the last verse I've printed there. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. This is David lamenting Jonathan's death. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women. Depth of friendship, crucial to life. And the significance of friendship is flagged up all over the Bible, but right at the beginning, it's flagged up for us. So do you remember Genesis 1 and 2, right at the beginning of the Bible? And God's creating this, that, and the other, and every time something's created, it said, and it was good, and it was good, and it was good. And then something comes along, and it's not good. Sin hasn't entered the world. It's a perfect world, a creation, paradise, and yet there's something which isn't good. And it says this, God said, it is not good for the man to be alone. And it's obviously talking about Eve being created, and there's lots there to say about marriage and sex and relationships and so on. But more fundamental than that, think about this. Even the Garden of Eden, so it's paradise. It's perfection. It's a perfect world. Even the Garden of Eden wasn't enough for Adam without friendship, without companionship. Adam needed a friend. Now, why is that? And the answer is because we are hardwired to need friends, to need companions. The Bible says it by saying that God created human beings with something that makes us distinct from anything else in the world. We were created, unlike anything else, we were created in the image of God. Now, what does that mean? It means that in some sense, probably in various senses, human beings are like God in the way we are. Well, in what way? Here's one way that's relevant to this topic, and I know it's sort of hard to get our minds around, but the Bible, as you read the Bible through, it becomes crystal clear that God isn't just God. God is three persons. God is the Father, and he's his Son, Jesus, and he's the Holy Spirit who he sends to live with us and in us. And all three of them are God, one God, but three persons. It's hard to get our minds around. But what that means is that before God created anything, friendship already existed. Relationship already existed. It lies right at the heart of who God is. Loving relationship. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And so when it says that we are made in God's image, means we are, one of the things it means is that we are made for, at the very core of our being, just like at the very core of God's being, we are made for friendship. We are hardwired that way. And the Bible highlights the significance of that. And we need to remember that, because the world, our society, our culture, tends not to flag up friendship as that important to us. Think of the signals society and culture send us. So think of the glossy magazine that you'll buy tomorrow for your coffee break. What will be the topics on the front of the glossy magazine? It won't be who's best friends with who. will it, in the celebrity world? No one's interested in who's best friends with who. It'll be who's sleeping with who, or, you know, there'll be euphemisms for it, but that's the issue. In other words, what we're interested in is people's romantic lives, not particularly people's friendship lives. Or, saying this morning, think of the songs that are written. So if we were to make a pile of, let's be not exactly up to date and say CDs, because they're physical and you can see them and you can't make a pile of downloads, can you? But if you were to make a pile of CDs and you make a pile of songs about romantic relationships and a pile of songs about friendship relationships, which pile would be bigger? The thing that the friendships, the relationships that culture spotlights for us are romantic relationships rather than friendship relationships. And the Bible pushes back at that and says friendship is very, very important. And it's worth thinking about the issue of friendship within the context of church, isn't it? So they say that the size of church, the size of, or any group of people, but thinking of a church particularly, but any group of people, the size at which you stop being able to know everybody, know everyone or something about everybody, know everybody's names, sort of interact with people over time, is about 120 people. After that, it's too big for everyone to sort of, not at an intimate level, we can only know deep friendships, you know, a handful of people, but broader than that, about 120 people. And across all the congregations at St. Andrew's, we're about 400 people. So we're beyond that. It is impossible in this church to get to know everybody who considers themselves a member of St. Andrew's. And therefore, if we're going to have meaningful friendships with each other, we're going to have to, that's not just going to happen. It's something you have to invest in and be deliberate about, which is why our smaller groupings of all different kinds are so important to the fabric of our relationships at church. So, you know, they say as church gets bigger, simultaneously needs to get smaller in various ways. And so on the back of the notice sheet, we've printed this week some of those smaller groupings. Some of them are Bible study groups, but not all of them. And there are different ways of engaging and getting to know people, ways into the church family. I mean, I think meeting together to look at the Bible or Christianity Explored is crucial for our spiritual health, but there are other ways as well that people belong to St. Andrew's and begin to get to know each other. And it may be that a next step for you is to express your interest in one of those, say, oh, well, maybe that's the way I could get a bit more into church life. It's not the sort of thing that happens by accident in a larger church, which brings us to the challenge of friendship. So that's the significance of friendship. Secondly, the challenge of friendship. What is friendship? What is it? Given its significance, the Bible does have a lot to say about friendship, Book of Proverbs especially. Matt Thompson preached a great sermon on friendship from Proverbs 2 or 3 years ago. Maybe it's on the website. Alex is saying probably not. No, Alex has deleted it. He didn't think it was very good. But it was a great sermon on friendship. We're not going to look at that level of detail now. But just looking at this friendship of Jonathan and David, two things emerge. There is that friendship involves commitment, and friendship involves costliness. So friendship involves commitment and cost. Commitment. So that, like I said a moment ago, that verse 3 at the beginning of the reading, Jonathan made a covenant with David. A covenant is a committed relationship where you make a promise. Now, they must have formalized it, but they said to each other, we're friends and we mean it, and we're committed to each other. That is a commitment. A covenant relationship is different to a user relationship, okay? Now, you can use people in a bad way, but there's also just a very normal way in which user relationships work. So many relationships have to work like this. So the relationship I have with the paper shop, with our news agent, is a user relationship. It's a friendly relationship, but I don't have a friendship relationship with the owner of the news agents. They don't expect that I will be committed to buy papers from them for the rest of my life until I die. It's not that kind of is friendly, but it's not friendship, it's a user relationship. And it's changed over time. When I first arrived, we bought a daily paper from that shop. We got the Herald, and then I realized it's a waste of money. You can just look on your phone or on the website, get it that way. We also used to get the Church Times through them, and Catherine got fed up because there were unread Church Times all over the house because it's dull as ditch water, so I've stopped getting that one. So the only thing we now get from the newsagent is the Beano. Just for the kids, yeah? Just for the kids. Don't ever read it myself. So it's a user relationship. That's fine. That's okay. That's the way those things work. They don't expect a kind of commitment. I don't expect them to be committed to that. But some relationships are commitment relationships, the most important relationships. And David and Jonathan recognize that and flag that up in their own relationship. And I guess that's not something that happens accidentally. It doesn't need to be formal, like Jonathan and David made it, but you don't drift into friendship. If you drift, friendships drift. Whereas if you're deliberate about the commitment, that is to say, time, helping someone, talking, getting to know each other, that's the sort of thing I guess we're talking about. And particularly costliness. Just before we get to that, one of the reasons that's challenging to be a friend is because as soon as you commit to anything, you close down other options. This is how one guy I read this week puts it. He said, our society is prone to worship what he calls the God of open options. And he says, the God of open options is cruel and vindictive. He will break your heart. He will not let anyone get too close to you. But at the same time, because he is so spiteful, he will not let anyone get too far away, because that would mean they would no longer be an option. On and on it continues, frustrating, comforting, but then endlessly pushing towards and then pushing away like the tide on a beach, never finally committing one way or the other, this, that, never really putting 2 feet in. He says, we have been like a starving man, we have become like a starving man sitting in front of an all-you-can-eat buffet, dying simply because he couldn't choose between the chicken or the shrimps. The God of open options is also a liar. He promises you that by keeping your options open, you can have everything and everyone, but in the end, you get nothing and no one. Do you see what it is? Another way to say it is it's fear of missing out. I won't commit to this, because if I do, I might miss out on that. And our options are so broad, our communications are so good in our society, it's a genuine problem. And there are lots of reasons why people don't commit in friendships, but that's one of them that I see in our own society at the moment. So commitment. And the reason we're shy of commitment, of course, is the costliness of that. One of the costs is it closes down other options, but there are all sorts of costs in friendships, aren't there? Jonathan's friendship with David was very costly to Jonathan. Look at verse 4 again, just there. It's curious, verse 4. It says, Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. So Jonathan takes off his significant garments. Now, what's going on there? What's the significance of that? Well, think about who Jonathan is. Jonathan is the prince, the son of the king in waiting. So what's the robe he's wearing? It's the royal robe. So when he takes off the royal robe and gives it to David, what's he saying? He's saying, I'm not going to be king one day. You're going to be king one day. It's an act of abdication to take off the royal robe. He's saying, I hand my kingdom and the right to reign over to you. How costly must that have been for Jonathan to do? They should have been rivals. Look at verse 17 at the bottom. Again, he says, don't be afraid. My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel, and I will be second to you. And he doesn't mean I'll be your prime minister or something. He means I'll play second fiddle to you from now on. You'll be first, that is to say, you'll be the winner, and I'll be the loser. What a costly friendship this was to Jonathan. And his friendship with David, it complicated Jonathan's life enormously. To commit to David meant that he's going to have to live in the same household as his dad, who wanted to kill David. So it was an incredibly difficult relationship to get involved in. But somehow, because he's this kind of person, Jonathan, he's a committed person. He somehow remained loyal to his dad as well, even following his dad into a doomed battle where he was finally slain. Friendship does that. Friends need you, and sometimes that's a very costly thing to engage in. And it can look different, can't it? Thousand different ways that costliness can surface. There are just some lovely ways that I'm conscious of here at St. Andrew's. There's a lovely lady who comes to the 9:30 service who every single evening phones one of the gentlemen who is now housebound so she can encourage him at the end of the day, who otherwise would be very lonely. Isn't that a lovely thing to be doing day by day, week in, week out, that kind of costliness? And of course, this is sometimes a reason why friendship in marriage wanes and fades, because friendship always involves commitment and cost. And sometimes the marriage is there, but the reluctance to do costly things, make sacrifices, is somehow put to one side. So what I want to do just to finish is by speaking about the ultimate friendship, significance of friendship, but friendship is challenging. Just think with me, last thing, about the ultimate friendship. No friendships are ultimate in the sense that every friendship lets us down one way or another, because we're all sinners, so we're going to mess up in friendships. And in any case, all friendships come to an end eventually. Phil Reed, who passed away a few weeks ago, a couple of months before he died, one of the things he said to me was, "Joe, it feels like all my friends are dying." That's a difficult situation to get to in life. And a number of us among us, and come in the morning, are experiencing that desperate stage of life where people are beginning to die more frequently than they used to, and friendships, which are precious and valuable, coming to an end. No earthly friendship will ever truly satisfy us. Won't last forever. So here's the last thing I want to say about David and Jonathan's friendship. Perhaps the greatest significance of their friendship is the friendship it pushes our eyes towards. Because think about who David was. David was the king in waiting. They even call him the Christ. So you can't think about Jonathan and David's friendship, the friendship Jonathan have had with the Christ, without thinking about the friendship we have with the Christ. Who is David? He's God's king in waiting. He's the Christ. And what does Jonathan do? He does what we do when we become Christians. He says, "I'll give up my kingdom, and you have your kingdom, David." We say to Jesus, "I'll give up my kingdom and let your kingdom come, Jesus." Now, Jesus himself picked up on this friendship language. He said, "Greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends." And he said to his disciples, "You are my friends if you do what I command." So do you see that in a relationship with Jesus, there is a two-way costly commitment. He is committed to us in a costly way, and we in response are committed to him in a costly way. He has loved us to the utmost and laid down his life to give us our life forevermore. So do you remember that scene in the garden the night before he died? And he's stressed out and anxious about going to the cross, and he's praying, "Lord, isn't there another way?" And what does he need at that moment most of all? He needs the support of his friends, and he says to the disciples, pray this evening, pray. And he goes back to see how they're getting on with it, and they've nodded off. Their friendship. And then later that evening, when the soldiers come to arrest Jesus, where are Jesus' friends? They leg it. And as that song says that we're going to sing in a minute, you see Jesus carrying his cross to the hill. Such a frail and lonely man. And the point is that he entered into that loneliness in order to give us access to the ultimate friendship. A friendship with God which will never end and which will truly satisfy forever and ever and ever. So what am I saying? Am I saying that when we have Jesus as our friend, we don't need other friends? I'm not saying that at all. In fact, the opposite. When we have Jesus as our friend, we find that Jesus' friends become our friends too. So C.S. Lewis put it like this. He said, a friendship often starts with someone when you find yourself saying to them, what? You too? What? You like those books too? Or what? You're into dogs as well? Or what? You like that music that no one else listens to? Do you see, you discover a common interest and a friendship springs up, often between very otherwise very different people. And the ultimate expression of that is when we say to each other, you too? You've said to Jesus, your kingdom, Jesus, not mine. I've said that. I know he loves me and I love him. And we might be very different, but we've got that in common. And as we're drawn closer to Christ, we find we're drawn closer to others who love Jesus too. And so we find that friendship is a crucial part. Friendship with other Christians is a crucial part of living the Christian life. And maybe we might just reflect on this and say, well, what's touched me from what we've seen of Jonathan and David's friendship here? Is it that I need to come back and think, you know, friendship ought to be more significant in my life than it is? Or thinking of a particular friendship, we think, you know, I need just to think through again what the commitment and costliness of this friendship ought to be to me. Or I think of my friendship with Jesus, ask myself, is that drawing me closer to others who know him? Or am I maybe keeping my options open, unwilling to commit? Let's pray together.